This is the Booktopian podcast. My name's Jo Lewin, and I'm very, very excited today to be interviewing Yotam Ottolenghi. Have I said that correctly?
You did a marvelous job.
Excellent. I've been listening to you on your podcast to try and get that right. I'm a huge fan. Olivia here is a huge fan. We're very, very excited to be here today.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
That's excellent. How has your trip been so far to Australia?
I've been in Sydney for about 24 hours.
Okay.
And I'm battling with jet lag, but I'm okay. All right. No, it's great. I love coming to Australia, especially that I came from 0 degrees to 35 degrees.
Fabulous.
Yeah, it's great.
Have you had a chance to eat?
This morning I did the biggest mistake, and I put on social media, on Instagram, a picture of my breakfast, which was scrambled eggs with salmon and a bit of Vegemite, and everybody goes like, is that what you're eating in Australia? That's disgraceful. But I went to Christine Manfield yesterday for lunch, and she made a beautiful fish with all sorts of delicious Asian ingredients, and I was very satisfied. I was
excellent.
Very happy.
And how do you find the food in Australia in general, the food scene?
Oh, it's wonderful. It's what's not to like. I mean, it's actually, Australia is the one place that I really feel that I could get my kind of food anywhere. Because I love Middle Eastern food, and I love Asian food. Those are my strongest influences on my food at the moment. And you do it so well here because of the immigrants that have come here over the last, I don't know, 100 years. And so both Middle East and Lebanese and Greek is just fantastic. And then all the Asian food that I went to, I go and have like a good Vietnamese pho in Melbourne. Last time I was here, a friend took me, and then I had some fantastic Thai food as well in Melbourne. Yep. And I mean, there's just so much.
There is. We're very lucky. We're very lucky. More than just a curry.
More than just a curry.
We're very, very lucky. So you are out here promoting, is it your seventh book?
Yeah.
Simple, which is a bit of a departure for you because you're known for being a little bit not simple.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was the idea behind this latest offering? Yeah.
So this is the reason for this book is my sister.
Mm-hmm.
And people like her. So my sister always says to me, you know, I love your food when you cook it for me, but I will never cook myself because I'm just too busy.
Yes.
She said, I've got three kids. I've got better things to do than, you know, go and buy 25 ingredients and then sit around to cook for 2 days and wash up for 3 days. It's just not my kind of thing. And although I'm kind of overstating it, I think over the years I have become famous for not having the simplest recipes. I don't think they're technically challenging, but there's a set of ingredients you want to go and buy, and there would be a few steps.
Lots of process.
And if I'm honest, if someone looks through my recipes before Simple, they will find tons of recipes that are actually very easy to make. But as a whole, that's the kind of the image that people had. So when a few years ago, The Guardian newspaper in London asked me to come up with some seasonal recipes for 20 recipes for the spring.
Yep.
And they had to be simple or easy. And I thought like, I pulled my hair out. I said like, I don't do simple or easy. What am I going to do about that? And but I took the challenge, and myself and my co-authors, Tara Wigley and Esme Howarth, we just sat down, and within 45 minutes we had 20 great ideas. And I think what was the change of the way of thinking was that we could actually do things that we would do at home that we didn't even think are recipe worthy.
You know, like
first of all, things that you do, a lot of the recipes are quite a significant number of the recipe are like cupboard recipes.
Yeah.
So, you know, things with rice and pasta or potatoes or things that are simple, but you can make really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
So we just took a whole different approach to the process. And I never took a recipe that I published before and thought, oh, I'll pare it down and I can lose this, that. That just feels like cannibalism,
cheating.
You know, like you take something that you really love and you destroy it. We just did wonderful things that made sense on their own. So, for instance, Esme, she's British, and she worked a lot on boats, like as a cook, as a chef. And she had like amazing recipes for jacket potato.
Yes.
So there's two recipes in the book for jacket potato.
Yeah.
And we just thought, oh, but how could we make it more Ottolenghi? So like more exciting than just a jacket potato. So the one of them has gorgonzola cheese and walnuts and lots of butter, and it's kind of rich and really good, and some spinach. The other one, we did like a tonnato-based sauce and put an egg inside and capers. And so essentially take things that are approachable and easy to do, but just give them the twist to give create that kind of an exciting, bold experience that you get with Ottolenghi food. And I think it worked. I mean, people do say that they don't feel that they are cheated by recipes. But another thing that I thought was really important for this book is, because there's many recipe books at the moment, or for quite a while now, that have the word simple or easy as a title. And for me, we needed to give it a little bit of thought. What does simple or easy cooking mean? And one of the things that I realized very early on is that in the conversations, like we had conversations with people, and we realized what people have very different understandings of the word simple or easy. Like what is easy for me is not easy for you. Mm-hmm. And vice versa. I mean, we just have and everybody brings their own kind of psychology into the kitchen. So what we did is I started talking to people and say, oh, so what's your easy cooking? What is your ideal way of cooking simply? And someone said to me, oh, for me, easy is just half an hour's cooking. I don't want to spend more than half an hour on a dish, which I completely understand. Yeah. Other people say, oh, it's just everything. I'd like to cook everything ahead of time. Mm-hmm. And when people come, just throw it on a plate or stick it in the oven and forget about it.
Mm-hmm.
And other people said, I just like the kind of the stewy and roasty kind of things where you just put a lot of things in a pan or a pot and forget about it for 3 hours.
Come back.
So these kind of are the different categories of simplicity that we used in order to shape the book. So we tried to include recipes that are simple in at least one of the six ways. And we use the word simple, the letters in the word simple, S-I-M-P-L-E, as categories of simplicity. So if a recipe has an I above it, then it's an ingredient, short on ingredients, only up to 10 ingredients. If it's got a P, it's a pantry-led recipe. Yes. So that's something that you can make from things that you make. Mm-hmm. You are likely to have in your freezer or your pantry. So every recipe is simple for one particular reason or more, and that's kind of clearly indicated in the book.
Mm. So you're very famous, obviously, for lots of ingredients and in particular lots of spices.
Mm-hmm.
And in this book, you've pared that right down to what you've called the 10 Ottolenghi ingredients. How did you pare it down? How did you choose?
It was like drawing blood. So how do you pare down 200 ingredients down to 10, right? Because I've got so many ingredients that I love. So essentially the book obviously has more than 10 ingredients, but what we try to do is to suggest to people, if you buy 10 key or core Ottolenghi ingredients, or not even 10, but like 7 out or 8 out of those, essentially you get to go quite far with this book without having to run to your local, to the closest Middle Eastern grocer every time.
Yeah.
So, you know, there would be familiar ingredients that people would have known, like pomegranate molasses or preserved lemons or za'atar there.
Yeah, which you can buy in the supermarket now.
Rose harissa. Or rose harissa, which is a bit more harder. Or black garlic, which is available in some supermarkets and others. So I tried to kind of choose 10 ingredients that are relatively easy to get and say, go buy those ingredients and then you can cook from this book quite a bit without having to go and find niche
shop
ingredients.
Shop for each recipe.
Yeah, so that's delivering on the promise of simplicity on another level, on the ingredient level. Mm. And what is so special about those ingredients, or some of them, is that essentially some of the work has been done for you. So if you think about rose harissa or any harissa, essentially, you take something which has got chilies that's been dried, and so when you dry a chili, you develop the flavor, and then turn and pound it into a paste with maybe some cumin and some oil, etc. So it's like a flavor bomb.
They've done quite a bit of the heavy lifting.
Same is for black garlic. Black garlic is garlic that's been aged and fermented. Again, it's like a flavor bomb. Pomegranate molasses, it's got sweetness and acidity in the reduction process of the pomegranate juice. Again, preserved lemon, another example. So essentially you buy those ingredients in order to allow you to do a little bit less
yes.
when you cook. And I'm yep. not talking about a Thai curry paste where essentially everything it's is one, in there. Yeah. Because yeah, that's too much of a cheat. But things yeah. that are kind of basic building blocks of flavor, mm-hmm. which you can take mm-hmm. and turn something good into something marvelous.
Yeah. Amazing. So unlike Plenty and Plenty More, your beloved vegetarian cookbooks, yeah. this one does have some meat recipes, but it's still very, very vegetable focused.
Yeah.
But I hear you're not a vegetarian no. yourself. So what's behind so many veggie recipes? Yeah.
Well, to be honest, I think when I published Plenty, which yeah. is 10 years ago, and 11 now, and Plenty More about 4 years after mm-hmm. that, I was operating in a world which is quite different from our world today. Yeah. So they used to be, there were vegetarians and non-vegetarians mm-hmm. and or vegans, vegetarians and mm-hmm. omnivores. And each one was very much in the whole, each group was kind of to itself, mm. right? There was very little fluidity in the way, mm-hmm. the way people ate and defined themselves and the way they eat. And now in 2019, this has changed quite a bit. So I'm not saying there's more vegetarians and vegans than there were 10 years ago, but there is a lot of people that love to eat a lot of vegetables, mm-hmm. self-included, who are not vegetarians and vegan. They just want to eat vegetables all the time. And in this book, I just thought, and also that's what we do in the restaurant. We cater for those kind of people. Like, I eat vegetables most of the time. And that's what I want to have most of the time. But I'm not partial to chicken.
Yeah.
So I don't want to alienate a group of people, but I still want everybody to eat more vegetables because they're so good.
Yes.
So that this book just kind of reflects this hierarchy in my life and in the life of many people these days, that vegetables are on top. Mm-hmm. Vegetables are what we want to eat. Vegetables is what is good for us and for the environment and for everything. But we're not as strict. So people kind of shift and are fluid in their choices. And the book reflects that. So
great.
At the top of the hierarchy would be our vegetables. So 70% of the recipes in the book are vegetarian.
Uh-huh.
And 25% or so are meat and fish focused.
Great. So another, I guess another subject other than food that's really close to your heart is your family. And you have a, not your average nuclear family.
Yeah.
And I believe that you're quite an advocate for diverse families and so forth. Do you want to tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. So I am married to a man and we have two boys, Max and Flynn. Max is 6 and Flynn is 3.5. And we have the process in which we have had our children was nothing but straightforward. It was hard and in a way, I think I've always known that I wanted to have kids, but I never knew that I would necessarily have them because I was gay and it was complicated. But about 10 years ago, we embarked on this journey to have kids. Mm-hmm. And this journey was, as you said, it was hard, but it was also interesting and enlightening because we, for part of it, we tried to co-parent, so to have children with women who could carry kids for us, and then to have a kind of a family that would include two households.
Right.
For all sorts of reasons, this didn't work. And then eventually my husband, Carl, and I went to America and had two boys through surrogacy.
Mm-hmm.
And when our first son was born, Max, I've just decided to tell the story in a big piece that I've written in The Guardian.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why I did that, first of all, it wasn't so clear to me that I wanted to talk about it because I thought it was a kind of private thing. I'm a chef. I'm not a social commentator. You know, that's not my job to tell the world how to live. I'm food focused. But then Carl actually was pushing me to write about it because he said, you know, the journey that we went on is very relevant and many gay men don't really know so much about this. And It's very difficult for gay women. It can get pregnant more easily and can have children more easily than gay men. And you really need to talk about it. So I decided to write this piece. And in a sense, I think it's really important. It has become really important to me to to carry that flag to a degree. I don't talk about it all the time, and I'm not an activist in this field, but it's very important for people to know that in this transparency, this openness makes people understand that this is possible, this is doable. There's a lot of issues, social issues, legal issues that need to be solved, and each country has its own set of problems for gay parenting. But I think not talking about it would be avoiding the subject and not really putting it on the table. And we have a lovely family. We have two beautiful boys. One of them has just turned 6. And, you know, I feel extremely lucky to have that in my life. It's a much richer life. And we love every minute of it.
Yeah. That's fantastic. That's a really great story. And great for people to see how loving and beautiful different kinds of families are.
Yeah, because also, you know, especially now in 2019, where the world unfortunately has become a bit more belligerent and people are looking back and closing down on gay rights, and there's more racism around and things that, and then it's really important that to stand upright for what you stand for.
That's
because
great.
We're not in a good place, really. There's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of fraction around. So I think it's good. Everybody that can tell a positive story about diversity should tell that story.
Mm. Well, yeah, here in Australia, we've only had same-sex marriage for just over 12 months.
Yeah. Which is very exciting.
Which is very exciting. So we are moving forward, not as quickly as the UK perhaps, but we are, and that's a great thing.
We have our own share of problems.
Yes. Well, look, thank you so much, Yotam, for speaking with me today. We have had such great success with your cookbooks. Australia loves you.
I love it back.
I'm glad you do. Thank you very much. All of Yotam's books are obviously available to purchase on Booktopia. And we look forward to seeing you again next time you come out.
Thank you. And well done on your first podcast. It was
fantastic. I know. I was terribly nervous. Thank you for being so kind and gentle.
Pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. Don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.